All right. Oh, man. I ate too much curry, man. Mike, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
It was good meeting up, finally, in Jersey, where in typical Jersey fashion, we had like some really rich Korean fusion food, I would call that, with Adam. Adam was there.
Adam was there. Yeah, the fusion food, it was pretty good. It was very good.
And then we wound up at a carnival. So that's just very Jersey.
Yeah, we wound up in a carnival. I mean, it was not like South Jersey, but it's like, you know, it's one of those standard fairs. And some of the rides look like, well, I wouldn't ride on them. Or I wouldn't, if I had kids, I wouldn't let them ride on it.
That's true carny, roadshow carny carnival.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man, I just had some pork katsu curry that I made myself. I was talking with some Twitter mutuals about Japanese food into the Southern California area, and I got it in my head that I hadn't eaten curry in a while.
Oh, is this like the box curry stuff, or you?
Yeah, like nothing special, man. Like S&B curry blocks, you know.
Yeah, I use those, but I usually use what is it? Like I just put like chopped veggies, so just potatoes, carrots, onions, and then just like beef chunks or chicken.
I did. I got like some pork tenderloin.
Oh, that's fancy.
Up, and then I crusted it in panko and then air fried it.
Oh, okay. So you basically did those, like, you know, you put the curry on top of the rice and then you drizzle the curry.
Excuse me. I put the rice in the middle, right? Usually with the curry, I can't believe we're gonna spend half an hour talking about this. Like, usually I see rice on one side of the plate and then like a sort of like it's like a curry coast. You know, it's like...
No, I know what you mean. Like, in the Japanese restaurants, they would put the
curry on one side, rice on the other. Yeah,
rice on the other.
I go for a rice island. I put the rice in the middle, and I surround it in an ocean of curry. So it's a rice island, and then I put the katsu right on top of the...
Oh, okay.
On top of the rice island. And when it's time for me to eat, I spoon the curry onto the katsu and the rice simultaneously. It's very joyful.
I've never done like katsu with curry, because I always put the meat in the curry. But I put the meat, but usually I just put it like dump it like a volcano, so it's just like flatbed of rice or rice little, and then just dump it straight down,
just right on top. Yeah,
you know, I'm from the north, right? So we just do it straight up, simple.
The problem when you like really like something and then like something like curry, it's like very filling. It's like rice and potatoes.
Oh yeah,
but it's so good, and I haven't had it in too long, and I inhaled two servings of it, large ones, and now I'm groaning. I'm like really full.
I know exactly how you feel because whenever I make those, it's like it ends up usually that way. And then when I was a lot of times. When I was in college living alone and I make it, or in the graduate program, when I was living by myself, I made a huge batch. And then usually after, like, it would last me like 2 to 3 days. And after the 3 days, it's like, all right, I've had enough of curry.
I've had enough of this for like the next 6 months.
Exactly. And then 6 months later, you're like really craving it.
Craving again. Oh, man.
And then it's that cycle that just goes on and on. So it's
like I heard that the reason... Okay, so curry is an Indian food ostensibly, right?
Yeah.
But I heard that the Japanese actually got it from the British because the British were serving curry on the Royal Navy and the Japanese were aping the British and decided to adapt curry for their Navy. And that's the origin of Japanese curry rice.
I don't know the story about that, but it's very plausible. I mean, you know, the opening up. During the 19th century, and when the Japanese realized there was just a lot of superiority and, you know, of technology and of customs in the West, they basically copied a lot of things from the West. So this actually would not be a surprise.
Which makes sense given how the placement, like in our discussion of the placement of rice in a curry dish, we're using sort of oceanic type topographies. You know, is it a litoral dish where you have a coast and maybe some chunks of potatoes and carrots as islands? Do you have an island of rice, or do you just have a submerged seabed of rice and, you know, sort of blue water curry on top of that? But, oh man, I'm full. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're not here to talk about curry. We're here to talk about what? The end of the world? What are we talking about? We're talking
It could be the end of the world, but it's the next round of escalations, it seems like.
It's honestly terrifying. It is terrifying. I think people who are not paying attention may think that this is overreaction, or it's just it's just sort of theoretical. Mm-hmm. But I was watching an ABC News, whatever that guy's name, the ABC anchor guy.
Yeah.
I forgot his name. They're all generic now, but he was the sort of youngish, good looking guy. And he was interviewing Biden, who I think was at Normandy, you know, for the 80th anniversary of D-Day, which already has all sorts of, weird symbolism to it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting here.
Well, on a side note, it's always really funny to me when they have these D-Day memorials and the Russians really aren't there, but the Germans are. So that always I find very, I guess,
funny. Ironic.
Ironic, funny, comical. And then, it's obvious why this is the case, but still, it's funny nonetheless. So just that as an aside.
Yeah, well, it goes back to saluting people who fought against the Russians during World War II.
Oh, yeah, remember that NATO commercial on Twitter? And then it's, like, talking about this band of, like, I forgot what the name was, but, like, this partisans in Estonia that was, like, resisting the Soviets. And then eventually someone ended up, like, highlighting, it's like, yeah, most of their work was, for the Nazis, and, killing, ethnic Jews and ethnic Slavs in Estonia. And then NATO is just promoting them.
Yeah.
I mean, is it any worse than basically inviting that Galician guy, the Junca guy, into the Canadian Parliament, giving him a standing ovation?
It was an oversight. We didn't notice. We didn't notice he was an SS officer.
So I will say this. I mean, I don't know if you know much about Canadian politics, but that is definitely something that Christina Freeland's office did. Used to be the foreign minister, but now is the deputy prime minister in Canada. And she, I think, I don't study Canadian politics and I don't read too much about it, but there was at a time, maybe she still is, like, talks about her being the potential successor to Justin Trudeau.
Oh, Lord.
And the thing is, her grandfather is, I would say at least at a very minimum Nazi sympathizer.
Yeah, I heard about this.
People say, like, I talked to one of my props who's Russian. He's like, no, her grandfather is a goddamn Nazi collaborator who ran basically the newspapers that they spread in occupied Ukraine.
Yeah.
Spewing out vile anti-Semitic, anti-Soviet messaging. And she would talk very glowingly about her grandfather that way. And I'm not saying that, maybe my standards are low, but, like, if you have a grandfather who, like, I don't know, worked as a Nazi collaborator, I'm not saying you are forever banished from politics, but at a very minimum, you can't talk, like, you should not be allowed to talk about your grandfather in respectable society. And yet here we are letting her talk very, talk very good things, nice things about her grandfather. And she has been, part of that wave in Canada that basically rehabilitated, you could say, a lot of the Nazi elements in the Ukrainian partisans in the Second World War that collaborated with the Germans and the Nazis.
I want to move. Let's talk. I want to talk about World War III and nuclear war first. But I do want to move. Mm-hmm. As you say this about Friedland, I'm starting to think maybe because I do like talk. One of the things I try to do. Mm-hmm. Is break taboos and, we're not supposed to talk. We're supposed to listen and be lectured to about anti-Semitism and stuff. But I feel like there's a sinister element to that, which I actually find quite anti-Semitic in the way that it's being done.
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you one example.
And I want to talk about that. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'll give you one quick example. You know that David Goldman guy?
Yeah. The pro China guy.
The pro China who's like, and then just like when October 7th. Guy. Yeah, after October 7th, just like really vile Islamophobia and stuff.
Yeah.
He was basically saying, oh, you know why Spain, he, like one of his tweets, he's like, he basically said, I could send it to you if you want, just briefly on Twitter. Let me see if I could find it. But he basically says, let me see. I think I have it. I reposted it. I mean, this is, it's pretty crazy what he says. It's like, here's the full quote. Why did Spain recognize Palestine? The Spanish have never forgiven the Jews for 1492 when the Catholic monarchs gave the Jews the choice of exile or conversion. Half of Spain's 200,000 to 300,000 Jews stayed and converted and got their revenge from inside Spanish culture, De Roja Celestina, Triso Don Juan's play, and Convertas Don Quixote were converted Jewish critiques of Spanish characters. The Spanish can't look into the mirror of their culture without seeing a Jew laughing at their silly pretensions.
Yeah. That's
and crazy. This shit is and this shit is fucked up because the way that he framed this, saying that the Jews basically became conversos and undermined Spanish culture inside, that is some crazy anti-Semitic.
Isn't that playing into the trope, you know? I want to talk about that. Yeah.
This is like exactly I don't know if you listeners know this, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, it's like a fake document that the Russians forged, and apparently, you know, that the Russians forged, it's a fake document the turn of the 20th century, but it's basically one of the foundational documents for anti-Semites, and they're pointing to this document called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and it's allegedly basically a meeting between all the secret cabal of Jewish conspirators trying to undermine, you know, secretly undermine, you know, traditional Christian societies by bringing in Western values and liberal democratic values and Marxism and all the modern, you know, modernity, you could say, philosophy modernity. Like David Goldman's tweet, like, exemplifies that trope that you would find in the Elders of Zion. That
shit. It's crazy. You know, it echoes like some of the stuff I've been seeing coming out of like the Bill Ackman camp. You know, online and stuff like I saw some tweet saying that, you know, the Maldives decided to reject.
Oh, yeah. And then
Israeli. And then I saw these tweets going like, do you know how many rich Jews have just decided to completely tank, you know, the Maldives tourism economy because we're not going to go there? And then, you know, this is, you know, Bill Ackman retweeted that and said, yeah, it's off my bucket list. Too, not to mention, you know, all the stuff that's been going on about, like, basically putting together blacklists of people who have protested.
Putting in blacklists or, you know, like, some of the pro-Zionists. I think today they tweeted some high school girls, you know, she was a black girl's, what is it, yearbook?
Yeah, picture. Yeah, and she had said, from the river to the sea, where she's going to school, and all, like, this stuff. But, like, I just think this whole thing about saying, like, if you go against us, rich Jews are going to crush you and we're not going to hire you and we're going to destroy your economy. I'm like, that, you know, you guys are not doing regular Jewish people any fucking favors by saying these things. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is really, like, talk about, you know, sort of, I mean, and I got to say, I mean, I will say I have seen an increase in really disturbing anti-Semitic memes and shit online.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and it's fucking disturbing. And people really do feel like they have license to just go like that now. And then I have mutuals on Twitter who will just say stuff like, you know, just the most anti-Semitic shit ever. And I mean, it's despicable. But I like, at the same time, I'm like, we need to be. People who are, I think Zionists need to be, I think that there is a backlash against this, and this cry of anti-Semitism is sort of self-fulfilling right now, and it's disturbing because anti-Semitism is really creepy, the way it comes out.
Anti-Semitism is really creepy, and it's also in a way used to scapegoat, basically, people's, it's it's basically a really bad answer for a good question, which is what is happening as the economic modernization is taking place. Basically, what is happening when we see our deteriorating living standards? Whereas, if you know, at the turn of the 20th century, anti-Semitism was basically saying, well, all the problems that you see in modern society, it's the fault of the Jews, right?
Right.
And then basically now what is crazy is that you have these Zionists who are screaming on the top of their lungs, you know, conducting these very horrific policies, you know, in Israel, conducting very horrific policies towards the Gazans and the Palestinians. And then at domestically in Western Europe and North America, using their disproportionate influences to try to suppress any type of dissent, basically. And that, you know, you've seen the article in New York Times, right? About, you know, rich donors giving to Eric Adams' campaign, saying, look, if you crack down on the college.
Oh, yeah. You mean with like the private chat group?
Yeah. All of these things. And it plays into very much that trope of basically the anti-Semitic, you know, trope of the Jews controlling the economy or controlling all of society.
Yeah, like a secret Jewish cabal.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
But I think people, I think, you know, what I would like to make clear is that there is a distinction between Zionism and Judaism and the Jewish population, right? That is a major distinction.
It's a distinction that's not merely rhetorical. There are some very extremely anti-Zionist, committed anti-Zionist parts of the Jewish world.
You know, people tend to forget when Zionism as an ideology was given birth, which is around the late 19th century Europe. And it's the conditions that it was given birth to was the increasing hostility towards the Jewish population. The initial Zionism, you know, Theodor Herzl and whatnot, there was huge pushback towards Zionism within the, you know, the general Jewish population. And the pushback is like, look, you know, yes, we are religiously Jewish, but that is not the core component of our identity, right? We're German first, or we're Czech, or we're French first. And to say that Judaism is the primary identifier for all, you know, Jewish people, you know, that's not just putting a target on our back, but it's also the very different historical experiences from what we have, right? And, you know, before the Holocaust, the westernized Jews within Europe, they didn't have anything in common with the Eastern Jews in Eastern Europe that lived in the ghettos. You know, one of my professors, he basically, his family was Western. Basically, they were Jews from Germany, and you know what her grandmother would say about Jews from the East, from basically Eastern Europe, from Poland, or generally her attitude towards Poland or Eastern. Basically, she would say to, you know, east of Berlin, there is nothing. That was a general attitude. Mm-hmm. And both sides look down on each other. On each other. So there is, you know, that historical sense that, you know, people tend to forget that long, long history. So and you know, people do need to be reminded that Zionism is not the same thing as Judaism, and it's not the same thing as, you know, the Jewish population. In fact, some of the most committed, you know, anti-Zionists, they're Jewish, right? Like if you Ilan Pape, Noam Chomsky, Aaron Mate. I mean, yes, they are a minority. They are not yet a majority. But the voices that have lent, you know, to the BDS have done a lot of important work. Norman Finkelstein, you know, they're Jewish.
Yeah. Also, you know, I'm starting to realize, I'm starting to hear more about how, like, it's easy to take a Finkelstein or a Mate and just say, like, you know, there's like individual liberal dissenters and, you know, but and you'll hear this all the time, this refrain that like true Jews are Zionist and there's like a 1% set of like liberal sellouts that are not, but they don't mean anything, you know. But then there's also, which I don't understand very well, but there is an ultra Orthodox side of the Jewish world that is very anti-Zionist. for religious reasons. Not really on the same not I would say necessarily on exactly the same grounds as sort of like, you know, liberal anti-Zionist Jews. And I don't know, I want to read, like, one time I went to this town by accident. Me and my wife drove through Kiryas Joel, which is a very large, it's a small city. I mean, I wouldn't even call it a town anymore. It's a small city in near Woodbury Commons in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And it's all Orthodox, Satmar sect, ultra-Orthodox Jews. Mm-hmm. And they're all anti-Zionist. Like, that's the basis of the Satmar sect.
Well, and you have to, I'm not an expert on the Orthodox, and I don't know too much about them, but one has to remember Zionism, how it started. It's a political movement, right? It's an infusion of the 19th century ideas of, you know, European nationalism, that the Jewish people deserve their, you know, a homeland, right? And you could say in a way that does run counter to the more religious notion of what Judaism is. Yeah, I'm not. I think maybe a good resource might be Ilan Poppin. He wrote a book called The 10 Myths of Israel. And briefly, he talks about basically the tensions between Zionism and Zionism and religious Judaism, and also basically the, you know, historically existing Jewish organizations advocating for Jewish rights at the 19th century in Europe. Because when Zionism first started, there was a lot of pushback from Jewish populations themselves. It was only after, you know, the Second World War and the horrors of the Holocaust in which Zionism gained a lot of traction.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a novel by Chaim Potok called The Chosen, which I think a lot of people read in high school. Mm-hmm. I never read it. But it talks about a friendship between two Jewish boys in the 60s, and one comes from a, quote, like a modern Orthodox family, like sort of more, like heading towards Reform Jew, and an ultra Orthodox, a kid from an ultra Orthodox family, and things are, you know, they become really good friends, but then one of them attends a Zionist rally, a pro-Zionist rally, and the other, the ultra-Orthodox, the father warns the kid, okay, you can't hang out with him anymore. And so I was just like, you know, obviously this novel is structured around a little bit of the differences in feeling about the Zionist movement and how it really was quite the rift within even sort of like New York City Jewry. And I'm like, very interesting. You know, like I just think like right now the Zionist Israeli... fuck it. I mean, we might as well just stick on this topic. it's so interesting. Okay, this is what I think is going on is, you know how they say like every accusation is an admission?
It's a confession. Yeah.
It's a confession. Like there's some of this weird shit going on where I feel like the typical anti-Semitic trope is these manipulative hook-nosed Jews who are sort of like manipulating people into doing their bidding. Right. And so they'll create, you know, one of the big things is they believe that it's Jews who are creating racial tension between white and black and, you know, directing black people to, you know, cause all sorts of fucking problems in white America, you know, whatever. Just this sort of like secret Jew behind the curtain kind of shit.
The secret cabal. You know, the elders, if people want, if our audience wants, there is a good book talking about, you know, the anti-Semitism. And the anti-Semitism that we're talking about is the much more modern variation anti-Semitism, right? Because there is a historical anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
You know, you saw in Spain or, you know, the old school anti-Semitism that, you know, the various Jewish expulsion, which is based on religion, the anti-Semitism.
Yeah, there's a really famous painting at the Prado
that
shows this. But yeah, it's a remarkable painting. But yeah.
But you know, I want to make it clear to the audience that the anti-Semitism that we're talking about is the modern anti-Semitism.
Stems from like the protocols of
The Elders of Zion, or the notion that the Jews are the ones responsible for the degradation of European and American societies and cultures at the, you know, with the modernity. With,
yeah,
you know.
So let's take this idea about the secret Jew, you know, that's manipulating and creating all the chaos and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sitting here watching Biden give a speech at some point about, I think this was on, it was fairly recently, and I think he even went to the Holocaust Memorial mm-hmm. To give this speech, and he kept saying that basically this was done for the, that we are doing, we're supporting Israel on behalf of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And that supporting Israel is our pledge to the Jewish people never again, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, you know, this is a really weird, this is a really great setup for, like, non-Jewish white people, mm-hmm. in a way. Or non-Jewish people, period, right? Is, like, when, if, not if, when all of this, the when this is finally understood to have been one of the great crimes against humanity, right? Mm-hmm. When there's no longer any, like, you know, even now, like, not that long after the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, we can kind of see that it was wrong, right? I don't mm-hmm. think it's going to take that long for us to, you know, for there to be a consensus building that this was awful, right? But but at that point, I think that there's already an inbuilt excuse, a built-in excuse here, mm-hmm. which is to say that this was all done for Jewish people. So, it, you know, I think, like, in a way, the trope is actually reversed. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that Biden keeps saying that this is done in the name of Jewish people is also a hedge to say, like, to the extent that there's a guilty verdict later, to the extent that, you know, we need to be held accountable for what was done, our excuse is going to be like, well, we did it for the Jews because that's what they wanted us to do. And I don't know, if I were Jewish, I'd be very wary of that, mm-hmm. you know, and I think a lot of Jews who are protesting against Israel right now, I suspect are feeling a little bit of that, to be like, you know, can you please stop saying that you're doing it for us? Because it sounds an awful lot like a prepackaged excuse.
But it also,
we're going to shove Jewish people and say into the limelight and say, oh, if you need to find someone responsible, criminally responsible, morally responsible, it's this guy right here. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I also think it's a way to couch hide American interests,
right,
in their in themselves in the Middle East. Why? Because if you have Israel, and Israel is constantly generating tensions with Iran, you have an unstable Middle East, which would basically allow the United States to go to various other Arab states like Saudi Arabia and say to them, basically, look, you know, you have all of this tensions and they don't get along with basically the Iranians. And then if there is high tension between the Israelis and the Iranians, all the other states inevitably are going to be dragged in. So it makes it more and more that the Saudis, rather than being less reliant on Americans, would be more reliant upon Americans as a provider of security to make sure that no instability is leaking out in the Middle East. So it's also used in such a way, I would say, to couch or hide American interests and American positions in the Middle East. If that makes sense.
For sure. For sure. And the fact that it's you know, I have to feel that at some level, like, there is a degree of, like, insanity, like, that's mm-hmm. going on, I feel, when it comes to the rhetoric coming out of extreme Zionists. And maybe there is this nothing but extreme Zionists. Maybe Zionism is a form of extremism.
Well, I mean, this is actually really great. And I would encourage, you know, our audiences to listen to some of what Ilan Pappe was saying. Because,
how do you spell that, by the way? Pappe?
Pappe? P-A-P-P-E.
Okay. Pappe!
So it's Ilan Pappe. So I think I-L-A-N and then P-A-P-P-E.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty funny because he was giving a talk, I think, in Michigan somewhere. And then when he landed in the airport, you know, the basically airport security took him in And I don't know if it was the FBI or something, but someone from, you know, Homeland Security questioned him for 2 hours and took his phone and asked him, does he condemn Hamas, and does he support the statement from the river to the sea, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but what's interesting was, and he was saying this like 11 years ago, right? And he was, I didn't read this piece, but he said he wrote a piece, you know, when Americans were enamored with the Oslo peace process, the Oslo Accord, and the peace process in the Middle East.
This is a two, this is sort of like pursuit of a two state.
Pursuit of two state solution. So yeah. Late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
Ilan Pappe said in the 2000s, he wrote an article saying that if you actually look at Israeli society, you know, you should not be optimistic, because the things they teach in high school in Israeli society really dehumanizes the Palestinians. And in the future, you are going to get basically, you know, a very, very extreme regime in Israel. And essentially it's what you are seeing, because the original founding of Israel, you know, there was a lot of committed socialists among them, right? But as Israel goes on, you have basically a much more right-wing leaning until you get someone like Netanyahu, and you get basically a lot of these current politicians who are extremely right-wing. And eventually, you know, as Ilan Pappe would say, it's because there is a contradiction within Zionist ideology. Yes, it was founded by very liberal elements, and sometimes you could even say socialist elements within basically the Zionist societies. But, you know, the reality of Zionism, the reality of trying to maintain, you know, the dominance in the West Bank basically inevitably leads to saying, well, like, come on, you know, what is more important, the liberal values or actually the dominance of, you know, the Jewish state within basically Israel and Palestine? And eventually they would choose the latter, and then the former would be abandoned. So this is where you're seeing basically some of the more extremist ideology now coming to fruit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does. And it's, I just think the thing, I guess what I'm saying is the extremism and the irrationality of a lot of this, it's like a fervor, you know?
Oh yeah.
And I feel like this sounds like I'm having some kind of like sympathy for it. I'm not really, but I am just saying that if I were Jewish, I would look at such fervor and irrationality as a weakness of the Jewish people, where I do think that it's being used. They're being set up
to be, they're the being set up.
Yeah. And we are encouraging this fervor. Mm-hmm. Because it makes them do irrational things. And a lot of people have pointed out, like, how is this good for Israel long term? How is this good? You know, like, it's not.
Well,
and
I honestly don't,
you know, all this talk about how America is a slave to Israel, I think is bullshit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know AIPAC is an extremely influential thing. I understand all this, but I think that the longer game here, I still think that Jews are being set up as the scapegoat.
Well, I don't know if Jews are being consciously set up as the scapegoat or Zionists, but I think when
Biden, for example, goes out and says all the things he says, I do think that it is. I'm not saying it's an intentional conspiracy, mm-hmm, to set up the Jewish people. I think they know that it's convenient rhetoric to make themselves look good while, mm-hmm, doing horrible things, mm-hmm, and making sure that there's a distinction between what the Israelis do and what we do.
But if that's the case, I mean, you wouldn't have John Kirby, you know, going up on TV saying, you know, all the things that the Israeli did, we've also done even worse. In fact, the Israelis are better than we are. You know, we've done some of these things in Iraq, even though I don't think, you know, the American occupation of Iraq was, you know.
Yeah, but that's over with. You know, I think a lot of this, if you look at it, and I'm not saying that their minds are necessarily in the future on this right now, mm-hmm, but it, you know, I do think that these patterns occur where the overall attitude, mm-hmm, lends itself to the development in of this situation in a direction whereby the whereby Americans at large will say, we are actually the moral ones here. We were supporting the Jewish people. We were supporting the Jewish state. And we want to give them as wide a latitude to do what they need to do. Now, were there atrocities? Yes, but that's on them. That's Kirby's overall message, is that's on them. We have expressed our frustration, but we told them that they need to be, you know, better at targeting or be more careful. We need to see less civilian deaths. But ultimately, you know, we are supporting them because this is what they've told us they need from us. And I think that that attitude lends itself naturally to an outcome later down the road where we wash our hands of this and say everything that we did was simply done for the benefit of the Jewish people. This is what they wanted to do. Talk to them about the atrocities. Talk to them about the dead civilians.
But I don't think this is... It might work in America. I don't think it'll work in the rest of the world. And the reason why...
I think it'll work in Europe.
It's not going to work where it matters, which is, you know, with the Islamic world. I mean, you know...
I don't know if that really matters, though, because I, you know, I do... I think that a lot of this has to do with... It has a lot to do with power within the West, who holds it, and who gets blamed for, you know, who takes the fall for the things that the West has done. And look, it's just like 2008. Who ultimately, who are the only people that took a real fall for all the financial, for all of the financial misdeeds? It was a Jewish man and a Chinese family.
Chinese bank, right?
Yeah.
And then Bernie Madoff.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a pattern that repeats. And I think that the blame for all this will fall on the Jews. Now, if you look at it from a global perspective, okay, maybe it's a little different story distinguish. But, but I'm talking about within the West, within the United States, within Europe. I think... within the West, I think all of this, like, I would say almost hyperventilation about anti-Semitism is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because I have seen indications that anti-Semitism is going to be a growing and real problem.
Yeah.
And all the stuff that's going, and it's not the fault of protesters. It is the fault of Zionists who have, this is my opinion, okay? Who have fallen for the trap of saying that all these horrible things that are being done for Jewish people, for the Jewish religion, for the Jewish people. And I'm like, I don't know, man. If I was Jewish, I'd be very scared to hear that.
So the reason I think the assumption you're saying that this would work in the West and also in America, I'm not as sure, is I think there's an underlying assumption, is that there will be an information monopoly and dominance within the West and America that's going to primarily remain there. And I'm not sure about
that. I don't think they need information dominance here because this is not a the reaction, the backlash to this is not a top-down media phenomenon. This is something that people are thinking,
but
that's what I'm saying. And the stuff that I've seen, the way that both the right and the left have started to become more comfortable with just straight up anti-Semitism is the expected backlash against the way that the U.S. the American state has collaborated with Israeli Zionism.
Well, you want to hear, I guess this is the other thing, maybe.
And it's scary.
Well, it's scary, but I also think you're saying it does Jews no favors.
I don't think it does.
No, it doesn't. But I do think it is a perfect Zionist strategy because you put Jews in a position of extremes where they are eventually going to be forced to embrace either Zionism, no matter how horrible it is. Because on the other side, you're just seeing all these really anti-Semitic and really horrid things that are saying. So I just
find, for example, lately, Piers Morgan has been very much like surprisingly full-throated in condemning the IDF and Israel,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and Netanyahu, and saying like, I am morally outraged at the things you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and that to me is such a British thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this whole fucking thing is a British construct. Like, this all started with you motherfuckers. All right. Yeah. Like, if there's a truly guilty party here and you want to go to the beginning, it's the fucking British. But the way that the Brits are going to react to this is like, they created the problem. They support the Zionists. They go all in. And once it starts to get really ugly, once they've assessed that global opinion has become unmanageably against Israel, then suddenly they like, oh my God, I'm morally outraged. This is disgusting. Mm-hmm. And then it's the Jews that are left holding the bag for the Piers Morgans of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I find that's really, and I'm just speaking here in terms of like, if I was Jewish,
mm-hmm.
how would I view this? And I would view that kind of thing as, I just think that there's a level of manipulation here that actually it's actually the opposite of the anti-Semitic trope. I think Jews are being set up, if you know what I mean.
No, I know what you mean, in the sense that when Zionists are saying we're doing this in the name of Jewish people, and then when you have various Western states giving such uncritical support, saying we're doing this for the Jewish people, when the truth is already leaking out, and when inevitably the narrative collapses, the blame is going to be on the Jewish people,
because exactly.
both sides would be saying, well, we did it for them, and then this is who they did it for.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's going to fly, because if you remember something in the Nuremberg trials, when they said, I was just following orders, even if you're uncritically, I'm just doing this in the name or for the Jewish people, you know, there is still a degree of culpability, in the sense you still have your own innate individual will. Well, why did you do it for them? Why didn't
you? Yeah, but that's a different thing, because
mm-hmm.
that had to do with like the actual Nazi, the actual Nazi and military apparatus mm-hmm. that was carrying out the orders, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the way that America has sort of stayed on the sidelines, is not really directly doing the thing, but is doing everything that is necessary to set up the thing. Just like mm-hmm. with Ukraine, like no boots on the ground, but we're going to give you everything you need to do. Political cover, military support, like materiel, all that stuff.
But if you look at...
You're going to be the one that has to do it, mm-hmm. and you're going to be the one that commits all the atrocities. And when the bell rings and it's time for there to be consequences, we're going to say that we were doing this out of
concern. We're just a third person. We're not an actual party to the conflict.
Yeah, and the only reason we're even mentioned is because of how much we care and love, care for and love the Jews.
But the thing is,
and that's just so disgustingly cynical to me.
It is, but it's also not going to fly with the victims. I mean, the Americans for the Palestinians and
I know we don't care, but we don't care about the victims. I mean, for all we care, we might as well just finish them off and then we'll deal with the consequences.
We don't care about them because we believe that they will never rise and they will never have a voice. But I think in a multipolar world, I think the West is going to be deeply mistaken if they hold that this assumption is going to hold. Just like it's going to be deeply mistaken.
Well, it only has to be true for their lifetime, because they don't care about the next generation. You know?
Oh, boy.
They're deeply self-centered people.
Well, these people.
But I will say that I do believe that anti-Semitism as a backlash and even an organizing principle or organizing feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know, among both a wider swath of the right wing and a sort of like sliver of the left.
Oh, I know what you mean.
It's going to be a problem.
I'll give you a very concrete example. You know that Mexican president that was newly elected?
Yeah.
And she's like Jewish. And I'm not saying I know her pro. I don't know anything about basically this lady, right? But just the immediate assumption, because she's Jewish, she's going to be pro-Israeli, or she's going to be this or that. It's, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's the case. But wouldn't it at least be rational and be reasonable for us to wait until she opens her mouth and give basically the official policies that she and the new Mexican government has, rather than make all the assumptions? And it goes back to your part about the rising anti-Semitism, in the sense, it's just that we assume every Jew is going to be pro-Israeli, right?
Yeah, and the ones that are not, you know, the media, which we keep saying is Jewish-controlled or whatever, but the second there's a Jewish voice who's anti-Zionist, pro-Palestine, critical of what Israel's doing, mm-hmm. they just get completely shut out. You don't hear from them at all.
They get shut out, and they get basically marginalized, as with a lot of, like, you know, Norm Falkenhayn, you know, Ilan Pappe, they're not a mainstream light in the American news.
Yeah.
And then they just fired, well, she's not Jewish, but what's her name? The African-American lady?
Brianna Gray-Joy? Or Joy Gray?
Yeah. Joy Gray. They just fired her from the Hill for, you know, taking basically, you know, questioning Zionist narratives.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're absolutely right in the sense. It's like all the voices, the Jewish voices, and I'm not saying they're a majority, but they are a sizable minority that you really can't ignore. Like the initial protest against October 7th, when they shut down, was it Grand Central? That was led by, was it Jewish Voice for Peace? I think.
Yep. That's right.
And then, you know, a lot of Jews that, you know, they're central to, you know, the struggle that basically that you see in the various protests. And it just seems like the media narrative is to wash them of that and to say that, no, every Jew is going to be in support of what Israel is doing. So you're not wrong in that sense.
Yeah. I just caution this topic because I think that there's been a lot of understandable dismissiveness among the pro-Palestinian movement, which I am very sympathetic to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there has been a dismissiveness about the concerns over anti-Semitism because I do think there is a boy who cried wolf aspect to this, which people have brought up. And I do think that there was a lot of crying of wolf, crying about a wolf that wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
But now maybe the wolf is there. I do think that the cynical way that they were using fears of anti-Semitism is going to come and become a problem because when the thing actually does become a problem, and it will, a lot of people will have been inoculated against it precisely because of the cynical way it was used. Mm-hmm. And this is such a simple lesson that we were supposed to learn about, you know, through children's tales, like The Boy Who Cried Wolf. We're supposed to understand this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard to understand, is it?
Well, could I say something? This is tied to basically, if we are moving into the next topic, you know, the policies America has with Russia. You would think that these are principles that are simple to understand, and you would think the basic principles of politics these people think that you should understand. But you got to remember, history has ended for these people and these policymakers. So it doesn't really matter what past history is. Those lessons no longer apply because history and its progress, they have ended.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that's what happens when you feel like you've reached the pinnacle, right?
Yeah.
You're just trying to keep everything the same. All you're doing is trying to fight off change and challengers.
And basically, not just fighting off change and challengers, but everything that questions my worldview or everything that is against my interest, no matter the moral question, they're all bad. And everything that is for me is all good, no matter the horrendous cost or moral cost and whatnot. So I think this is also the other aspect of it. It's not just blaming. I think these policymakers are really that dumb and are really that blind and are really that arrogant. Because they don't need to be anything else. You know, the worry for me is people don't realize, you know, especially, you know, don't realize is how fragile a lot of these world systems are and how fragile a lot of these policies are, and that it can be easily overturned. You know, these things that we think are set in stone, they're not, right? And these are just the people rocking the boats. I'm talking about a general feeling that I have mm-hmm. with our elite policymakers,
yeah,
rather than specifics. And so, you know, and you're right in the sense with Biden, because it's assumed, oh, we've learned the lesson of the Holocaust, so never be these things. Oh.
But that's them, mm-hmm. right? I'm more saying that I feel like they're able to, well, maybe they're not so able to anymore. But like,
no,
I feel like a lot of regular people, mm-hmm. you know, who are not served by, or who do not occupy positions of power, are not quite able to see this, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm overestimating mm-hmm. The ability of people to see these patterns, mm-hmm. like how, you know, the more cynically we use anti-Semitism mm-hmm. And fears of it, the more it opens up the door, the window for anti-Semitism to make a real comeback in mainstream.
Well, I would frame it this way. The more we use and we weaponize, the more that Zionists weaponize anti-Semitism to suppress any criticism of Israeli policies, especially towards the Palestinians as they're conducting these, you know, horrific policies, the mm-hmm. more it will engender a pushback from the general populace of the West,
right,
to embrace these tropes.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know, and maybe I am underestimating how difficult that may be to grasp. I think that seems pretty straightforward, but maybe people don't see it. But I mean, I think without a doubt, anti-Semitism is going to become a problem, because the cynical use of mm-hmm. the term anti-Semitism opens the window up for it, because now people dismiss it. People are like, haha, this isn't serious. You're using this to justify genocide, which they are. And so suddenly I'm seeing, like, you know, yesterday I had to report a thread, and a lot of mutuals I had, or people that I follow, were jumping in on this thread. It was a very bizarre thread mm-hmm. where people were like, hey, post your favorite and post the worst anti-Semitic memes that you've seen online. Mm-hmm. And I thought at first that this was going to be a serious thread to show.
It was going
to
be like how comical Zionists were using anti-Semitism to justify their war, and what you ended up.
No. Oh, okay. I thought what it was a. I thought it was a thread to say, show me the worst kinds of anti-Semitic memes you've seen online, mm-hmm. so that we can sort of just have a tracker to see like how bad this is getting.
Yeah.
I thought it was that kind of thread. Like, show me all the awful shit you've seen. And mm-hmm. that is what it was, mm-hmm. but it was all tongue in cheek. Mm-hmm. It was such an interesting thread, but I reported it because it was horrifying. But it was done as a tongue-in-cheek, we are doing this just to report on the horrors that we're seeing, and I'm totally not laughing at this. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, they are laughing at it.
Yeah.
And it was like a comedy thread. Mm-hmm. Of people posting some of the most horrendous shit you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to repeat what I saw.
But it was
a lot of Holocaust jokes and stuff, right? But it was people posting these memes and saying, I'm utterly horrified, and then a smiley face. Mm-hmm. You see, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, the whole thing was done tongue-in-cheek to say, I feel like the overall vibe was the window to anti-Semitism is a little bit open again. Straight up admiration of Hitler's policies, the window to that is slightly open again, that we can start, because they've opened the window, we can start posting joke threads about how all the awful stuff that we've seen and how, quote, horrified at it we are. So horrified, in fact, that I'm going to go ahead and post it on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very disturbing thread. And I was like, you know, fucking, I'm reporting this because I don't think this is doing anyone any favors.
Mm-hmm.
It was crazy. The shit I was seeing, I was like, I can't believe I'm seeing this. But there it was, you know, and I don't think that this is the fault of campus protesters. I don't think that's what it is.
It's a dynamic that we're seeing, basically Zionists circling the wagons and really intensifying the message and really, you know, pushing through to try to suppress any type of dissident dissent against basically Israel. So, and part of that would be that they would need to intensify, weaponize the anti-Semitism, the historical anti-Semitism, which there was a lot of in Western mm-hmm. societies, right? But in doing so, for a cause that is as odious as what Israel is doing now,
mm-hmm.
is going to basically eventually pave the way for a new wave of anti-Semitism.
Yes.
In Western Europe and the United States.
Yeah, it's going to be so bad, dude. That's my feeling. My gut feeling, and then seeing a thread like that and seeing how, you know, the feeling seems to be if anti-Semitism is so bad, mm-hmm. why are all of the tropes about it true? That seems to be the overall feeling behind what I think is going to be a resurgence of straight up, you know, Hitler apologism. And it's coming.
To be fair, we already have Hitler apologism coming with the uncritical support for Ukraine, right? You know, we are supporting basically some of the most odious people.
Yeah, but at least we pretend that, you know what I mean? Like, this is opening the door for just straight up saying, you know, actually, I'm going to just say this without real
cover.
I actually think, you know, you hear people say stuff like, I actually think that Hitler had a really good point.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be like, holy shit. Like, they just said that in public.
Yeah.
You know.
But I think maybe I'm more optimistic
mm-hmm.
in the sense because the non-Western, non-G7 world is not going to give the West a chance to forget the fact that they were not just sitting on the sidelines supporting the Jewish people.
When did we care about that? What did we care what they said?
Let me say, but here's the difference. It's not mm-hmm. that when did we care? Mm-hmm. It's that they now have the power to compel us to basically care. They will have the economic power saying, this is basically your policies. If you don't like it, you have to bring these people to account. In the past, they had no such power to compel this from the West.
Well, they better get... Here's the thing. I don't have much faith in the Islamic states. I feel like a lot of them are run by extremely corrupt
bureaucracies. This is an entirely different thread, right?
Yeah.
And this is beyond the purview of my expertise. But the Islamic world is, we have to remember, very large, right? I mean,
very large, but very fragmented and corrupted.
Well, I don't know if Indonesia is as bad as like Saudi Arabia. I mean, they got problems. And even Malaysia, I mean, that's a majority Islam country. Indonesia, I think, is either the biggest or the second biggest.
Yeah,
right with India.
But they're also further away from the action. I think it bugs the shit out of them. But I don't think it really is a call to arms for them the way it is for a lot of people living in the kingdoms. You mm-hmm. know, in the Arab kingdoms.
I mean,
no.
I don't like to say regimes need to collapse because in saying that, you're basically talking about a changing order, and whenever you do a change of political order, there is going to be a huge amount of cost in terms of human lives, in terms of disruptions. But yeah, but there, I don't disagree with you on the sense that there really does need to be a change in the regimes there, in the sense that they do need to fall or change drastically, in a sense.
It's just this overall fucking feeling of a little bit... it's like a little bit of a horror that I'm watching, mm-hmm. where I'm starting to see things that were never supposed to happen again, patterns that were never supposed to repeating again.
Well,
and
I'm like, because
how?
And it's very simple. It's because we think we transcended history, so we don't need to learn from history.
Yeah, there's no way this could be happening, and that's how it happens. Is because you're like, there's no way.
You know, I talk to close family members, and they're saying, "Mike, you're too negative sometimes. Why are you so negative about this stuff?" And I said, "Look, you don't study history with the way I do. You grew up, in a sense, yes, you grew up during, you know, the Cultural Revolution, all that stuff. You went through Tiananmen. But if I could be honest, your trajectory of your life was always up, 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 more and more stability, a better and better improving China." I said, "If I was to talk to grandma or grandpa, they might be more sympathetic to me because they actually seen what political instability is like and that things can go south very, very fast."
Yeah.
And I think one thing people need to understand and they need to get out of their head is that liberal Panglossian view of the world that things would work out. Things might not work out. And maybe the ultimate order, you know, ultimate end of the world is instability. And we're moving into that. And American policymakers are not doing themselves any favor. They're moving headfirst into this, whether it's this confrontation with China, whether it's uncritical support of Israel, whether it's basically, oh my God, supporting basically, you know, strikes within Russian territory.
Yeah.
I mean, these people think maybe history has ended and like they have absolutely no fucking clue what they're doing. You know, I think I sent you one of the YouTube. You got to really look at it. I think it's a very limited nuclear attack with
Jesus. Okay, yeah.
So let me see one sec.
I see it, Daniel Davis.
And deep dive.
Ted Postol.
Very good guy. And he said when he was talking to McFaul, right? He's like, "We want to basically have a seaborne anti-ballistic missile,
an offensive weapon.
An offensive weapon that's basically have these categories." And Ted Postol just asked him, you know, when he was an advisor, this was like, I don't know if it was in the Clinton era he was saying. I forgot it was President Clinton or Secretary Clinton. Might be President Clinton. Ted Postol basically said, you do realize like all the technical specifications of the weapons you're telling me this is going to be in direct violation of one of the treaties we signed with the Soviets. And the guy is like, "I don't know. I'm not an expert on this stuff."
He just like, cancel the treaty before you do it then.
Or like, you know, Ted Postol was, I think he was asking McFaul, it's like, "Why the hell do you want to like do this? Like, what is the point of trying to antagonize Putin?" And they're like, "He's just what is your end goal?" It's like, "We're just going to overthrow Putin and we can do it." And he's like, "Okay, how are you going to do it?" It's like, "I don't know, but we'll figure it out because we're Americans." I'm paraphrasing. And Ted Postol is like looking at these guys like, are they out of their fucking minds?
Yeah.
Like that is the type of arrogance and detachment from reality I think that we have with.
What's scary is, okay, so looping back to the beginning.
Before we depart, can I just say maybe some more optimistic things about Gaza and Israel?
Yeah, sure.
So I sent you this link also. Did you see it? It's called "The Beginning of the End of Zionism."
I saw the link. I'll put it in the show notes so people can follow it.
So this is the
Postol video and this as well.
Yeah. So basically, Ilan Pappe is saying he's predicting this, and I basically said around like not October, but around December, I basically said to one of my friends, you know, I'm not trying to be like dramatic or anything. I just said like, you know, from just how I see it, not as an expert, just from my cursory glance of history and what I'm reading, I said, there's a good chance that Gaza will die. But I think that, you know, from that, you're going to see Palestine be reborn. And what I mean by that is also what Ilan Pappe said, the beginning of the end of the Zionist regime. I think when Zionists are doing the things that they're doing in Gaza, this really is a dead end. Mm-hmm. And they really can't go forward. The next year or two is going to be really dark. And God knows what Israel has in store for Lebanon, even more of Gaza or the West Bank, because they're going to commit even more atrocities, and not even more intense atrocities. But I want listeners to also remember that the final solution, and this is the I'll jump in and you'll understand why. When the Nazis started the final solution, it was in basically 1942, right? When the invasion of the Soviets failed, didn't materialize, they didn't capture Moscow, and the tide of the war was turning. So they really started to basically do the final solution. You remember when I talked about, was it the Wannsee Conference? I think it was 42?
Yep.
That
great. By the way, great movie. Mm-hmm. I saw the British adaptation of it.
Mm-hmm.
The one with Kenneth Branagh and et cetera. Yeah. Excellent film. People should watch it. But yeah,
okay. But the point is,
the film, but you're talking about the real thing, the actual conference.
Yeah, the actual conference.
Yeah.
But that only happened, and the final solution only really came about when the Germans started losing. The Nazis, when they started losing, and they started doing this. So it's only, a lot of these atrocities, it's only at the end when, I'm not saying all of them. If you look at the atrocities that the Americans committed, obviously they never lost, but they still committed various atrocities. So it's not like a universal, but I'm saying for a lot of these, and I think the Zionist, what Israel is doing fits into this. We're seeing all of this precisely because the regime knows that it's fighting for its survival.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. No, I feel like a lot of this only makes sense from the perspective of, people who are like, it's this or annihilation.
Yeah. And what the Israelis have done more and more is basically delegitimize Zionism in the future. And also just, they might be able to inflict horrific suffering also in Lebanon by starting a war, but I think the Lebanese and the Hezbollahs would be able to bring a lot of pain to the Israeli regime, because what the last 6 months has shown is not just the genocide or the killing of tens of thousands of Gazans. It's also shown that the Israelis, the IDF of 1967 is not the IDF of 2024. They got 6 months and they couldn't wipe out Hamas. Well, the military option is becoming an option for a lot of people to realize that this is not the formidable force that defeated, a combined Egyptian and other Arab states in either 48 or 67. So I think in the long-term trajectory, this really is, the dawn before, the dawn before the darkness, right? But the next couple of months, or maybe the next 2 or 3 years, it's going to be a pretty dark period.
And we're at an hour 7. I think this would be a good time to pivot.
Sure.
And maybe we'll do this as a bonus. What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, that's fine.
Because I think that the missing piece, or not the missing piece, but I think the involvement of the Russians, is a very critical element to how we bridge the present to what the near term future is going to look like, and it's going to be a radically different situation.
Oh yeah,
And I believe that the Russians are going to play a big part in that, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, okay, sure. Wait, so the bonus, are we going to talk about the Russian?
Yeah, talk about the Russian piece here. So, for listeners who want to, if you want to support us on Patreon, get access to bonus pods, etc., just go to patreon.com/plantingmech.
Great. I could not recommend it more.
All right. So let's wait for 10 seconds and then we'll start. All right. Welcome back. It's the bonus. It's the second part of a two-part pod. First part is on the free feed. And we'll just kind of like get back into it. Mike, we were talking about the sort of near-term future for Israel, and how it could be a pretty dark time ahead. And I think that we have to start thinking about the moves that Russia is making, because I'm just throwing this out there. I don't know, right? I'm just telling you what I'm, what I, my gut reaction to what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. So it's the D-Day, 80th anniversary of the D-Day landing, and, you know, Biden is there in France, and he's being asked questions by the ABC News guy, whatever his name is. And the ABC News guy, to his credit, is a little bit freaked out by the decision by Biden and I guess a few others in, like, leading figures in NATO, Stoltenberg among them, that they're going to authorize the use of some of our long-range weaponry to strike inside Russia.
Not just inside Russia. Mm-hmm. They're striking the early warning systems that the Russians have.
Yes.
Which is absolutely insane.
Insane, right. Because that changes the calculus for a nuclear war, right? For
an basically, what is going to happen... I mean, it's not that nuclear war becomes inevitable, but miscalculations will, there will be more chances for miscalculations. And the reason why it's so dangerous that they're hitting the Russian early warning systems,
which they've already done. Yeah.
The Ukrainians is that
using Western weapons. Yeah.
I mean, there's a few things. First of all, it doesn't really help the Ukrainians because it's not like they have the nuclear weapons, right? So mm-hmm. they're just basically, you know, making sure that the Russians are going to guarantee a very, very harsh response to this type of attack. And basically, and I think maybe the Ukrainian, to be honest, maybe you're right that the Ukrainians are doing, I mean, if it's the Ukrainians are doing it, then it's basically their chance to try to get the Americans involved.
Yeah, they want to, they for the regime in Ukraine to survive, mm-hmm. what they have to do is escalate this war to the point where the Americans have to recommit. They have to get drawn back in.
Yeah.
You know.
But I don't think it's the Ukrainians that are doing it. I think it's the Americans, because they are the ones that have the targeting expertise and basically...
Right. And that's the second piece of this, which is that Putin, if people listen to what Putin has been saying, mm-hmm. he's been saying in very stark and harsh terms that if we were allowed as people, as Americans, to actually listen to what he said, we mm-hmm. might be a little bit freaked out, because this guy doesn't, he's not fucking around, right?
Well, of course he's.
And so it's gotten to the point where even ABC News is like, Mr. President, have you heard what Biden said? I mean, have you heard what Putin said? You know? And so this guy's like, you know,
he's a thug. He's a bad man. We don't need to care about what he said.
Right. So this is what Biden said. Mm-hmm. Like, and I remember this pretty well because I just saw it the other day and I was shocked.
Yeah.
He said, first of all, so the question was like, is your authorizing the use of American weapons systems to strike at Russia, you know, likely to lead to escalation and perhaps towards nuclear war?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very straightforward question. Like, that's, you know, rarely do you hear media ask such tough questions of Biden. You know what he said? Why do so many people think that the Russians are so strong? Do you know how many troops they've lost in Ukraine? They're weak. They can't respond to this. That's literally what he said. I was like, oh my God, this is just unbelievable delusion. Like, just, this is just lies. And then he said, you know, and then he said, well, what do you make of what Putin said about what would happen if, you know, these weapons were used to strike within Russia? And he said, you know, I've known Putin for 35 years and he's a despicable human being and nothing he says can be trusted. And I was just like, you know what? We're all going to die. Like, this is so unbelievably irresponsible and delusional.
Well, he's funny that he said
this is the president of the United States, and I think he's not going off script. I believe that he has the support of a lot of people in Washington in positions of authority and power.
Oh, neocons, yeah, probably a lot of those policy.
And I think, a lot of people who aren't considered classic neocons are classic neocons. I think Jake Sullivan is a pure neocon. Mm-hmm. I think Blinken is pure neocon. I think everyone on his foreign policy,
they would probably be described as more liberal intervention internationalists.
Yeah, but they're neocons at the end of the day. They end up doing the same shit.
Well, no, no. Liberal internationalists would try to bring, you know, their puppies along, right? Germany, Britain, France, and all
they bomb Nord Stream, so I don't really believe in that shit.
Yeah,
to the extent that you're saying that, I think it's just pure optics, but they were so fucking heavy-handed.
It is partly optics, but they bombed Nord Stream, but they made sure that Germany was okay with it in the sense, you know, in the back scene to make sure Germany doesn't make a scene, whereas neocons would have just bombed it without, you know, giving a care about the Western system, saying
we're just going to... At this point, at this late date, man, I think it's a distinction without a difference. You know what I mean? Like,
no,
it just really feels like I don't.
I mean, it ultimately, they both support basically the policy of American dominance in world affairs, unipolarity, and we got to maintain this no matter what the cost it is. And just on a complete off side note, he said he's known Putin for what, 35 years?
Yeah.
Well, that would probably make Biden a Russian asset, because Putin, that would make him know Putin in 89 and 90s. And during that time, before the fall of the Soviet Union, Putin was a KGB intelligence officer. So, you know, that just on a side note, if people are curious about that. But yeah, it is also what Biden exemplifies and exhibits, I think, with Western policymakers, is something I notice with historically a lot of Western analysis of Russian power, which is we either tend to overestimate its capabilities or we tend to underestimate its capabilities. We either completely despise it or we either in complete fear of it, if that makes sense.
This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. As usual, the second part will be on the Patreon feed, available to Patreon subscribers. If you want to support Plan A, go to patreon.com/planamag. Thank you.